Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name, the echo is haunting, the echo is always the same. I call your name, the echo is haunting, an echo can never be changed. So I call your name, your name.
And welcome to the Personal Experiences show on Signs of Life Radio. Hello, everybody. I'm Bob Ginsberg, and those who are regular listeners to this show are probably shocked to hear my voice, but Kim and Betty asked me to co-host with them tonight, and they're dear friends, and I love to be with them, so here I am. Janet is not able to be with us tonight, so we'll still have the three of us. Hello, Betty and Kim.
Hello.
Hi. And
we could add that we threatened you if you didn't show up.
Well, I'm glad the three of us are here. I don't know how you guys usually start your show, but I know, I was thinking back to when we originally started this particular show. And the reason I think we all agreed was that the only way that we're going to really change worldview about death is to encourage people to share what they experience. And all too often, people keep these extraordinary experiences to themselves for various fears, fear of being labeled or fear of being questioned, which is a shame. I'm sure you both agree, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And it's such a freeing experience, really, to be able to talk about it, because something happens when you share it with someone. You begin to see aspects of it you didn't see before and feel aspects you didn't feel before. So it's very powerful.
Yeah. And I should mention that we love your calls. And if you have anything that you would like to share with us, please give us a call. We don't bite. The number here is 888-627-6008. When we talk about personal experiences, I mean, I'm kind of preaching to the choir with our audience, but a lot of people, you know, when you say personal experiences, they don't really know what the hell you're talking about. You know, everybody has experience, but we're really referring to non-physical things, you know, signs, after-death communications. And I don't know if you get these things when you do the show, you know, these kinds of questions, but I know that in the foundation, very often we ask by people, you know, how do I know it's really a sign? How do I know that I'm just making it up or it's not a product of my own imagination? And the best answer that I could give people is that when you have a true communication, it's accompanied by this knowing.
Yes.
In other words, it just removes all doubt. It's just something that really can't be described. You know, just you know, there's with no question that this is, you know, a communication. I mean, does that make any sense?
It makes absolute sense. And so many people who have these experiences have described it in the way that it's realer than real. you just don't question it. It's so powerful. However, I do think that there's some experiences that are kind of in between, in which you're not quite sure, but you think probably. And I think very often the left brain gets in there, that rational analytic brain, saying this can't happen, because it's not in the purview of the left brain to see those things. So when the other parts of the brain experience it, they sometimes that left brain can be a problem. But I just think that if we're not absolutely certain, then we just stay with it and keep it as an open possibility, because other experiences will come in which you will absolutely know.
Yeah. How do you answer people when they say to you, that they're disappointed because they never get signs, or they never get communications, or they never have these kinds of extraordinary experiences that we talk about.
Yeah, that's always a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah. Because,
I had that when I was at still teaching at the college, and was having these experiences and dared to share them with the few faculty members with whom I was close. And they would say, well, yes, but you're different. That would never happen to me. That would never happen to me. And all I knew to say at that time was, but maybe that's why it doesn't happen, because you're so convinced it can't. You know, we really have to open up in a way that many of us we're not accustomed to opening up, to just saying, I do think it can happen. And just pray that that doubting in us will be quiet, and let us open up and be open to whatever comes. And I often say to people, we're a left brain culture. We have been taught and brainwashed for centuries that there is nothing. So we're that in between collection of generations that are trying to rebuild that bridge to the other side. So in order to do that work, we just have to do the best we can to be open, not close it off. Don't get disappointed, but continue to tell yourself that it is possible, because millions of other people have experienced it, and we're no different. You know, what do you tell them, Bob?
Well, I mean, the first thing, I mean, I could, from personal, my own personal experience, I mean, you have to be open to it. So, and I say that because I'm somebody that wasn't open to it. So if you don't believe, if you're not convinced, that life after death is possible. I mean, in the early stages when I was in grief, there were signs that were happening all around me, but I refused to accept them. I couldn't even recognize them, you know. And you know, and some of them were extraordinary, and I, you know, just kept dismissing it. It's coincidence, dismissing it, coincidence, and it took me, you know, many years before I relented. Under the weight of the evidence. But also when they say they don't get signs, you know, from their loved ones, or how come my loved one is not communicating with, does my loved one not love me, and that kind of thing. But I think that we're under the false assumption that once we pass over into spirit, we become experts in communication. I mean, think about it. I mean, we're entities of energy. We may not have even believed in our physical life that we go somewhere after we physically die. You know, so here we are in this new environment, and it's hard enough to get your bearings and adjust, let alone do things where you can implant thoughts into another consciousness, or psychokinesis, and, you know, make things happen. So I think that there's a learning curve, and plus the fact that I think people that are on the other side have unlimited possibilities. There's a lot of stuff to do. So, I mean, they realize that you're in grief, but they're not, you know, they're not grieving, because they know that they still exist and they're not gone, you know? So I think that I just tell people to, sometimes it may not be in our physical time. Sometimes it might take years before things happen, and then all of a sudden things happen like crazy. Kim, were you always a believer, or was this something that took some convincing?
Well, I used to hear stories growing up that my maternal grandmother told my mom about her grandpa, and he would do, this is a little bit not quite, well, it's a spiritual thing, but it was telekinetic. You know, Ruthie, go out on the front porch, and she'd go out and look, and she'd see the rocking chair rocking. So I don't know. It just kind of made me aware that there are powerful things and energetic things and forces I didn't understand, but it was interesting and I was open to it. I didn't experience anything or hear stories about the lights flashing or, you know, electronics going on and off, but somehow just knowing somebody was messing with my grandma a little bit and letting her know there's something big going on, Ruthie, you know, but I don't know if that's close enough, I'm open, and I find it interesting and exciting and inspiring. And one of the things too about people sometimes calling and saying that they haven't heard anything, they often just kind of inadvertently throw out a story that drops your jaw.
I know.
That they kind of just discounted.
That's right. Like you were saying, Bob.
So you've got to be receptive and kind of respectful of what comes.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day when we used to, you know, host these afterlife discussion groups, which were, you know, physical gatherings of people, and it was small groups and it was meant to be, you know, safe environments where people can open up and talk about these experiences. And sometimes, you know, Fran and I moderated a group in New York, and we noticed like new people were always coming in, but they would usually just sit in the group for an hour and a half and never utter a word. And that's okay. You know, they were just, you know, listening. And then they come to the next meeting, and the meetings were pretty far apart. And the same thing, you know, they would sit there quietly. And, you know, then it came around the third meeting, and they would start opening up, and they would tell these stories that are extraordinarily mind-boggling. You know, they're really dazzle shots, you know, and we just wanted to shake them. So where have you been? You know, why are you hiding this in, you know? So, and once the floodgates open, of course, then they started to love to share. You know, I told this story. I don't know if you ever heard it, Betty and Kim, but many years ago, it was about 2 years after my daughter passed, and I went to our family doctor, who was a friend of mine. I don't remember why I went, some ailment, but it was about 2 years. And he said, "Hi, Bob," and he greeted me. And he said, "You know, what have you been up to?" I said, "You really want to know?" And he says, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I'm studying survival of consciousness." And he looked at me, and then he, you know, went on, you know, talking a little bit. And then he stopped again, and he said, "Can I ask you something?" I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, what's survival of consciousness?" Well, you know, I don't usually volunteer, but he opened up the floodgates. So I started talking about our work and, you know, what we believe, that the mind can act independently, you know, of the brain, and we're more than our physical bodies. And we're going on and on. There's like a riot in his waiting room. The people, 45 minutes, were talking. His nurse walked in the room, and his nurse had just unfortunately lost a child to crib death, and she was very interested in the subject. So finally, we talk like another 20 minutes, and then she leaves, and he gets this real solemn, serious look on his face, and he said, "I have to tell you something." I said, "Okay." He said, "My father died 7 years ago." And I said, "Really? And I'm so sorry." And he said, "Well, I had a lot of, the morning that my father died, I had a lot of seriously ill patients in the hospital. So I had to call my answering service, you know, to check on them." And the person at the answering service said, "Oh, doctor, your father called this morning." And he said, "My father died this morning." And he said, "Oh, so, we're so sorry, doctor. We're so sorry. We must have gotten the message wrong. You must have said he was your father-in-law." He said, "My father-in-law has been dead for 15 years. He said, "What time did the message come in?" And they said, at 9:15. And he said, "Read me back the message." And the message was, "You know, Frank, it's me. I'm okay." Now, his father had died 15 minutes earlier, you know, at 9 o'clock. And this message came in at 9:15. So, you know, he's was shaken by that. And here it is. It's 7 years later. He had never mentioned this to a soul, not his wife, not his kids, nobody, you know, let alone a colleague, you know, nobody. I gave him an opportunity, because after he heard the stuff that was coming out of my mouth, he knew I wasn't going to question him. Yeah. And I guarantee you that it's been 20 years now, and he's never mentioned this to another soul, you know, besides me. And when I think about that, the reason I tell that story is, what a shame, you know, that he feels that he cannot share this with anybody, because it's quite extraordinary, right?
No, it is totally.
Oh, I mean, it should be told to everybody. I mean, that's some real evidence.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way you or I, you know, would look at it.
Yes. Oh, it just went so moving, and for people to hear that. I mean, and coming from someone who's a reliable person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's a shame. But, you know, it's getting better. You know, and I think in the past 20 years, it's a lot different now than it was, you know, 20 years ago.
Well, it certainly is. And thanks to Fran and you, that you both wanted programs that would allow people to tell their stories in a safe environment. That's huge, because I had the experience in teaching at college, and I taught a myth class, and we were studying other people's dreams and visions and spiritual traditions. And students would constantly from that class come into my office very privately and say, I want to tell you something I have never told anyone in my life. And they were knockout experiences. And yet they knew they would be ridiculed, or it would be dismissed and devalued. And once they were in a class where we were studying historical visions and dreams, that they felt that they could trust me. So I would say to them, you know, when you feel that you're strong enough and you can trust the class, perhaps you'll feel comfortable enough to saying it in the class. But they didn't, usually, because it was just, it was so powerful and so strange to our culture. But you and Fran have created programs where people have a space to do that. And this is one of them. And we have the Visionaries, which I think was Fran's idea, wasn't it?
Fran's baby.
Yeah. Yep. Because I'd had an experience with in New York. Kim and I were visiting my Hungarian daughter in New York, and Kim was going through, had just finished chemo, I guess, and was on another medicine and not feeling well. The guest room, we were in there with twin beds, and we had talked a while, and then she fell asleep, I guess, but suddenly there was this being that shot out of her across the room and stopped at the window and looked rather frantically back to me. And there was gauze, like coming from the waist up. It was gauze was unraveling. That's the first time in my life. That's not the kinds of experiences I usually have. Mm. That it was so real. It was realer than real. That entity was there. And I yelled out, what are you doing? And Kim didn't answer because she was gone. She was asleep. But that was so powerful. And in telling Fran, she said, okay, we're gonna start the Visionaries where you have people, you know, as a group, go to meeting and people talk about those things. But yes, it's just creating the space, making it a safe place where real experiences can be talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And you are listening to the Personal Experiences Show on Signs of Life Radio. And if you'd like to share anything with us, you can give us a call at 888-627-6008. Yeah, sometimes we have these, like the experience that you just, described, Betty. I mean, that's a wow, you know. And sometimes these experiences are very subtle, and sometimes they're powerful. I had an experience when my mom was in the last stage, and, you know, she was getting ready to pass. She was sitting in a reclining chair in her living room, and the family, we had some chairs set up in a semicircle, like facing her. And, you know, the chair that was directly in front of my mother was empty. And all of a sudden, my mother, as sick as she was, she reached out her hands, and she started reaching for her mother and started having a conversation with her deceased mom. Mm. And the other family members that were in the room said, just figured, okay, this is, you know, a product of a dying brain and she's hallucinating. But not Fred and I obviously knew what was going on. I mean, she was having what we would call a deathbed vision. So what happened was, in the middle of this, my father walked into the room and he saw the empty chair. So he went over and he sat down. Well, my mother threw a fit. Get up, get up. You know, my father had no idea that he sat on his mother-in-law. Oh, no. And try explaining that to my father. What did I have to get? What did I do? I had a conversation with him, but I don't know if he quite got it. But you know, so I mean, sometimes now, if you weren't familiar, I mean, if that had happened 22 years ago, let's say, I would think that she was hallucinating. I didn't know anything about end of life experiences and so forth, so I would have reacted the same way that my other family members did.
So. Well, then growing up, I was on my mother's side, and my father was much more aloof and very literal. My mother was kind of a dreamer and Irish, and had kind of the Irish family that would tell. We go up in the Ozark Mountains, where I had a Cherokee aunt, and they would get around the table with a oil lamp and talk about stories. So my mother was always open to that kind of thing, but my father was not. So I think that at least knowing that kind of openness in my mother, although there were never any real convincing experiences or even experiences that would help me to believe and know that there was a spiritual dimension, but it was just an awareness that there were strange things in the world. You know, so I was kind of open to that, always looking for what that really was all about. But there wasn't, when I was growing up, and there just wasn't much talk about this kind of thing, was there, Bob? I think even, I mean, you're younger than I am, but I don't think when you were in college, it wasn't much discussion of the spirit world, was there?
Only when we were doing psychedelic drugs.
That's true. I forgot. That's your generation. Yes, that's for sure. Well, that was kind of interesting thing when I was teaching mythology in the 60s. These students knew what was going on. They were open. The students were much more open and aware than the faculty, because, of course, many of them were working with LSD or other things. And that did open that part of the mind that was connected to the spirit.
You know, you reminded me of the story when my middle daughter, Corey, when she was, you know, she was in college, and she came back to visit. And, you know, we had already started the foundation for a couple of years, and that was running. And she came to Fran and I, and she said, "Look, I brought this stuff home. I haven't done it, but all my friends do." And she says, "And the reason I brought it home is that when my friends do it, they start talking the way you and Mom start talk about the afterlife, you know." it was a salvia, which is a
Corey, it was on to you. That's cute.
Well, you know, Bob, would you tell that story about when after Bailey died and the agreement she and her friend had? That was right after her death. I can't believe you didn't pay attention to that one.
I know, you know, I mean, and the friend would also look at me like, "You idiot, how could you not, you know?" Well, yeah, when my daughter Bailey was 13 years old, she made her best friend enter into a pact with her. And the agreement was that if one of them were to die, they were going to make up a sign. So, and they would communicate that sign to the other person so that the other person would know that they still exist. So I don't know how many 13-year-olds make their friends enter into such pacts, but I mean, that's the subject of another discussion. I think some kids know when their life is going to be short. But in any event, Bailey said to her friend that she was going to leave her a blue magic marker in an unusual place. So after Bailey's funeral, I didn't know this till well after, but Bailey's best friend came over the house and grabbed Fran and said, "I have to tell you something." And she told Fran about this pact. And she said that after I came home from the funeral, I walked into my bedroom, and then neatly placed on my computer keyboard was a blue magic marker. And she said to Fran, I don't own a blue band matching marker. And you know, and I certainly haven't used one in many years. And she said, I went around to my family and asked if anybody had been in my room, and they said no. So, you know, I mean, so that's one of those wow signs and communications that I totally ignore, you know.
You really did at the time? You didn't think, oh my heavens, that is.
No, I was at, you know, this was early on, and I just said, that's a nice coincidence, you know, but she must have,
We've always heard, oh, coincidence.
Yeah.
It's amazing that the brain can continue to do that when it's just too detailed to be a coincidence, you know? When I first heard that story, that was so amazing to me.
The one thing that happened early on that really made me think seriously that there's something going on is that you've as friends of ours, I mean, we probably told you this story, but after we moved to our house, where we lived for, you know, 20 years, when we first moved there, Bailey was really, really upset because she loved our old house, and she loved our old neighborhood, and she loved all her friends there, and she was really upset that we moved. And then literally every month she'd go to Fran and she'd try to convince Fran to drive her back to the old house of the old neighborhood and she wanted to ask the new owner it would be okay if she saw her old room. She just wanted to see her old room. She loved her old room. And Fran would say, Bailey, I can't. It's not appropriate. I can't knock on the door. We don't own the house and ask if you could see. It's not going to happen. And then she was relentless. And this went on for, I guess, 2 years. I mean, every month she'd do the same thing. And then after Bailey passed, it turns out that Fran's first cousin knew the people that bought our old house. And Fran's cousin was at a wedding or some affair where this family was also in attendance. And the woman who bought our house went up to Fran's cousin and said, I'm so sorry about your loss, and I have to tell you something. And she said that her daughter, the new owner's daughter, which was about the same age as Bailey was, had Bailey's old room. And the daughter came down at night and was a bit shaken, and she explained to her mom that she just saw a young girl walk across her room. And, you know, the mother said that the girl had never had a bad dream. She'd never had any type of, you know, negative experience or any type of, you know, paranormal experience. And she just assured her there must have been a dream and told her to go back to bed. Well, the next morning, the family was in the kitchen sitting and having breakfast, and the newspaper was on the table. And on the front page of the newspaper was the story of the accident that my son and my daughter were in and that Bailey had passed. And it turns out that she saw this woman, this girl, walk across the room about 15 minutes after Bailey had passed. Now, I looked at that, you know, even from my left brain, non-believing perspective, and I said, wait a second. I mean, well, I lived through this for 2 years. She would, you know, constantly pester Fran. The one thing that she wanted to do is see her old room. Where would be the first place that she would go?
Exactly. You know? So even you had to take notice of that, right?
Yeah. I mean, that I could not explain. And that gave me a certain degree of comfort, you know, because to me that was evidence that she still existed, you know, because it's, I mean, the odds against that, think about the timing right after the, you know, I mean, if you calculated the odds, it would be, you know, in the multi-millions to one, if that, you know.
Exactly. No, that's a really, really important one. You know, when back to you saying about at 13, how Bailey had said, if one of us died, Peachy and his friends had that pact too, that if the Pishti had told them, he said, listen, if one of us dies, he said, wouldn't it be a really great thing to take the ashes to sacred places, that our ashes would be taken to sacred places? And so when his girlfriend told me that when he died, I said, well, then we will do that. Then we will take his ashes to sacred places. I still have some of his ashes mixed now with his father's ashes, and I've taken them a few sacred places, like at Machu Picchu and various other places, but I haven't done it completely. But I just thought that, you know, I think, as you said, Bob, that I think sometimes our children have a sense that that is going to happen, because he was the one who had suggested it for the group.
Yeah. I don't know, you know, how that occurs. I don't know whether they're getting a, you know, a glimpse of the future, or it's just this sense of inner knowing. But I mean, that's the other thing I never paid attention to. I remember taking Bailey on a college tour, even though she was not ready for college. Her sister was 2 years older, so her sister was getting ready for college. So I figured, well, you know, Bailey's 2 years behind. We might as well, you know, knock off two birds with one stone. And she, Bailey, agreed to go on the tour. And we're taking this nice college tour with a guide. And then all of a sudden I'm looking around. I said to friend, where's Bailey? And then she like disappeared. And I looked off in a distance and I saw her sitting on a bench by herself. And I walked over there. And she was crying. There were tears rolling down her face. I said, what's the matter? And she said, Dad, I have so many things that I need to do with my life. What if I don't get a chance to do them?
Goodness. Oh, my goodness. That was really.
Yeah. And I said to her, like what a normal parent would say. What, Bailey, come on. You're 13 years old. You have your whole life ahead of you. You can do anything that you want. But, you know, and then I didn't think much about it afterwards. But after I look back, after she passed, there were a lot of things like that. So I think that I agree with you. I think that there are certain, you know, people and, you know, children that have some sort of a knowing that they have to cram a lot of things into the time that they have available.
Yes. And, you know, if on the other side, they are working to create their lives and making choices, they would certainly know that that's coming. But I think of my son, Pishti, who had a dream when he was not quite 12, almost 12, in which he was in a car accident. Well, no, that was a dream the year he died. The first dream at almost 12 was that he was in the hospital, up above the hospital's trauma center, and he could see right through the roof. And he saw he was in the operating room, and then he saw that he was in the recovery room and intensive care. And then suddenly there was a dark space, and then he was on the other side, and there was like a horseshoe. He was at the top of the horseshoe, and there were four boys to the left on the left side and four to the right. And there was an eternal fire in the center, and he saw the aura of the 10th boy right directly across from him. And he said, and I knew that we were all waiting for that 10th one, because 10 is the number of completeness. And I knew that that would be me. And when I arrived, I would be complete. And then he says, what do you think it means, Mom? But it was really, and then in the last year of his life, he had the one that he was actually in a car accident, which is the way that he was killed and died, and that he was taken to intensive care. And he even, in the dream, I said to him, if you choose to come back, you can come back whole and well. If you do not choose to come back, we will accept that. Now, how in the world I said that in the hospital? I did say it. And it was like something speaking through me, I guess. But and then when he told me the dream that morning, but I didn't remember that part. And when we were going through some of his papers with his girlfriend, Jenny, she said, oh, Betty, look at this. And when I looked at what he had me saying, it's exactly what I did say in the hospital. And he saw that there was someone working with him trying to save him until he said, but then someone said, let him go. He's going to be a vegetable.
He's been reduced to a vegetable permanently.
Oh, that's it. He's been reduced to a vegetable permanently. And then he was kind of going out of his body and coming back, going out of his body and coming back. And then he went zoom out of his body and kept going. And he said, I was going so fast that the planets popped as I went by and suns popped as I went by. And I thought, well, that's almost like a practice of dying. And it was in the year that he did die that he had that. Mm. And of course, he was in the accident. He was in the operation room. He was in the trauma center, intensive care. I did say those things to him. And it just, so those things, you know, you can't really dismiss as coincidence, can you?
No, not, I mean, it's, you know, it how can you? I mean, obviously he was plugged into a greater source that we could not even imagine. I don't know how you explain these things. And you were on the same wavelength, for lack of a better term, you know? Uh-huh. I mean, absolutely. I think you're, who knows? I mean, I they say that sometimes we can come back, you know, he could have been your father in another life, right?
Yeah, you wonder, you know, and then after he did pass, Ishvan, my husband, began to have experiences in which he realized that they were of the same soul, that sometimes they came in as one per both together, and other times they split up. And he said, we are doing this in multidimensional or in parallel worlds, you know, to some, in each case, like in a chemical experiment, you put a little something different in this test tube and a little something different in that.
Yeah.
Sometimes I thought, well, if we are doing this in parallel worlds, I wish from other those worlds I'd get some better information about how to do things in this one. But at any rate, that the same soul was kind of interesting when he actually experienced it, my husband, in a vision in which they were together, and he was telling his dad that. And then when they were born as one soul, then he just knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. When they were two, then Pishti would explain to him what was going on. But when he came back, I mean, he said, I knew we were one soul, and often in two different bodies. And I said, well, you don't remember it. But when I was, right after I went to Peru and came back, I had a vision in which I saw them as the same soul. And the spirit said to me, I had named him Ishvan Kovacs, just like his father, which had been done for several hundred years in his family. And the spirit said to me, you thought that you made the choice to name him Ishvan, but there was no choice. He had to be named that because they were the same soul. And when I came home, I said to Pishti what I'd experienced. And he didn't pay much attention. He said, oh, yeah, sounds about right. Went on doing what he was doing. I thought, is he in some trance or something? And when I said it to Ishvan, he did the same thing. And he did not remember that. When he had that first vision after Pishti died, he was telling me about it. And then I said, do you remember that I'd had that similar experience?
Wow.
But he had actually experienced it on the other side after Pishti's death. He was just, I mean, he was like you, Bob. He hadn't believed in a thing, you know, before. And he hadn't even been that interested.
Really? And, I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Oh, he was, I mean, he was very tolerant of me, and he wouldn't say anything negative, but you know, I tell that story about trying to tell him about a vision I had in Peru. I chose a bad time, I have to admit, because he's reading the sports section of the LA Times. I don't know what was wrong with me, but he could keep his eyes away from the paper. And I said, Pishti, you're not really, Ishvan, you're not really interested in this, are you? And he felt so bad. He said, I know what you're telling me is true, but I have never experienced anything like that, and I have no way to relate to it. And that was true until our son died, and those visions just totally transformed him. But our son said to him, Dad, because we're of one soul, he said, when you were little, you had these abilities, but he said, you had to lose that. Otherwise, you and Mom may not have been able to conceive me. And now that I'm on the other side, you can do that.
Again. I'll talk about seeing the big picture, right?
Yeah. Oh my, yeah. I mean, Bishop would just, he, my husband would just, he hadn't read much about it or anything. He'd come into my study and say, I've got 50 years to make up for. Give me, what should I read next?
Yeah, it's true. Well, listen, you know, trauma and loss is often a catalyst, you know, that kickstarts this exploration. And that seemed to be true in Ishvan's case, right?
Well, it certainly was true. And I was always looking, but I never did have the kind of experiences I had after he died. Then I knew I had the kinds of experiences in which they were realer than real.
Yeah.
And before that, I didn't. And yeah, so the death is transformative in so many different ways. Can be.
Mm-hmm. You know, years ago, we used to, there's so many things that I should go back to doing that we used to do, but we used to do a lot of surveys, and sometimes we would do these personal experiences surveys. You know, we would ask people to write in, you know, on a survey platform about their experiences, just to share exactly what we're doing now. And I used to have thousands and thousands of these accounts, and I used to have, you know, paper files of them all, which they're all lost in the from last year's hurricane. And unfortunately, the event platform that we use to house the surveys switched over, and I lost them there too. But there were a couple that I was able to pull out examples of what people would talk about, you know, signs that they got. I was just reading one. It said, I was in a bookstore with my daughter looking at spiritual theme books. I found one title that caught my eye. When I got home, I laid it on the table. My husband said, I see why you got that book. Look at the author. It's the same full name as my son, you know, who had passed, you know, which he hadn't seen at the time at the bookstore, you know. That's kind of weird, right? Where you would, I say weird, but, you know, it's not weird at all.
Uncanny.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Uncanny.
Yeah.
Well, the universe is so much more than we have allowed it to be in our mind. You know, I always think about, and I think I said that in Miracle of Death, that when I started having these experiences after Pishti's death, I realized it was like I had lived, as I said, in one square inch of reality and called it reality, you know, just so mysterious and so miraculous, actually, you know.
Yeah.
When we begin to get pieces of that and realize that, you know, I just wish I could experience more of it more often.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people asked me, well, you know, they just assumed, you know, because of all the work that we've done all the years, that after Fran passed, that I was going to be bombarded with signs and communications and so forth. But it, you know, it doesn't work that way. And I wasn't. I reasoned that, you know, Fran also knew that it took a lot to, when it came to these signs, for me to really buy into them, you know. So, and the way that her mind, you know, works, I figured she'd have to, she was waiting to come up with something that even I could not question. So what happened was, it was about, I guess it happened about a year and a half ago. After Fran passed, we had this thing, as I used to love to hold Fran's hand. I mean, her hands were soft and they were always warm and they were comforting, you know, and it got to the point where I was a real pest, you know, like, she'd got enough already, you know. It's like, I, even when we were driving, you know, I'd stick out my hand and point my thumb up so she could grasp my thumb, you know. So, and she would accommodate and she would do that. So after Fran passed, every single time that I was in the car, I would talk to her out loud and I would say, look, just to let me know you're there, you know, grab my thumb like you used to. And I'd hold out, you know, my thumb. Like, the people when I was at a red light must have thought I was insane, because here I am with my thumb stuck up talking to somebody and there was nobody in the seat. But so I did this for a year and a half. every single time I was in the car and nothing, but I didn't give up. And one day I'm driving home from someplace and I said, okay, out loud again, I said, yeah, I really need you to do this. You know, it's like a year and a half, you got to do this. And I stick out my thumb and something grasps my thumb and my thumb starts vibrating. And I mean, it's literally vibrating, you know, and then, and the vibration is now it's moving up and down my thumb, you know, from the base to the tip and back to the base. And it's not stopping, you know, it went on for like about, I'd say a good 15 minutes, you know, until I got home. It took me 15 minutes to get home. And when I got home, it stopped. And when I look at that, you know, remember we said at the beginning of the show that these signs are accompanied by a knowing. So yeah. When that happened, and it rarely happens to me, there was no doubt in my mind that this was Fran. I mean, I thanked her profusely, you know, out loud, because like there was no way. And of course, it had never happened before, and it hasn't happened since. But the way I reasoned it is that exactly what I thought, you know, she knew. And it probably took a lot to make this happen, but I wouldn't question it. And I don't, you know, so there's an example of a sign that comes attached to a knowing. And could there be some other possible explanation for it? I guess, but in my mind, I don't think there is.
It's too specific, you know.
It's so personal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so
wonderful about things, that you were persistent. And I think that's what's important for us to remember is that, you know, not to give up too quickly, because who, you know, what's going on in that other energy field and what's going on in this one and what it takes to do what they would, you know, are choosing to do and what we want them to do. I mean, we just have to be persistent and keep that focus. And you did.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's a good point, because sometimes, you know, we talk about electronic voice phenomena, and for people that don't know, it's a process by which you turn on a recording device, which these days is really your phone, and you know, you set your intention to somebody, a loved one in spirit, and you turn on the recorder for 20 seconds, 30 seconds tops, and then you play it back, and sometimes, you know, spirit is able to imprint a voice, you know, onto recording device. But, you know, from everything that I had read over the years, sometimes it could go, people try this for months or years, nothing. And then all of a sudden it happens, you know? So there's another example. I've talked to so many people that they sat with, like in circles with other people for a year or 18 months, and they just never gave up. And then all of a sudden they started getting these fabulous clear recordings of, you know, from people in spirit. So another example of, you know, of not giving up. And you know, from history, like the people that used to sit in these seances, you know, back in the day, and, you know, get these phenomenal results. Of course, some of them were totally fraudulent, but, you know, a lot of them were real. And they would say that they would sit in a circle, you know, for sometimes 2 years. Now, I'd give up. I'm not going to go sit. I would definitely give up. But so these people didn't. And then all of a sudden, you know, I don't think like I said before, I don't think it's an easy process. I think that our loved ones in spirit have mediums on the other side, you know, people in spirit that help others in spirit to be able to communicate.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. And we really don't have a good idea yet about what that energy field is quite like over there. And if there's no time, then a few years could go by with it. Here, you know,
it's a big deal.
Right. But I just think that we don't understand that energy well enough to really, you know, appreciate how much time it might take, or the difference in time, or how difficult it is. And especially, I think it's probably difficult with us because Jenny, my son's girlfriend, had an experience with him in which he kind of took her outside the planet so she could look at it, and there was all kinds of pollution around it. And he said, Jenny, that's not all physical pollution. That's what we call static or spiritual pollution from people thinking there is nothing. There's nothing there. All of the belief systems that are so negative are creating a pollution around the earth, and it makes it more difficult for spirit to get through and communicate with us here. Mm. That makes sense to me, doesn't it, to you?
Yeah, and also you've written about this and talked about this, you know, where there's these points of light that are out there, you know, that connect us all. So who knows how this information, I mean, we say we're all connected, but we don't know how, you know. Exactly. I mean, not only are we connected to other human beings on this earth, but we're connected to the entire universe in ways that we can't imagine.
Exactly. Yes. And those points of light are so powerful, because once we know and connect with that light, then we root ourselves in the planet and become like lighthouses, you know, so that light is more available to others, because we don't really work alone. Whatever we do, if it is loving and holding that light, then that does create a lighthouse that travels to others. We affect many, many others, and they affect us. And one of the most powerful visions I've ever had in my life was a vision in which the light came in this incredibly beautiful disc of cosmic consciousness and the love, so tremendous. But what they were communicating to me was that the light had been around our planet, a tremendous light, for a long time. And we had reached the tipping point. So many people love so deeply and have longed so extensively for this light, for this love, for healing, that now that light was able to connect to our planet. And it connects through people who love and root that light in the earth. So, and it just circling around the planet, but it's rooted now in the earth. And when I see some of the darkness that's going on, I think, you know, you can get down. I always say, no, you must remember that. That was realer than real, more so than anything I've ever experienced. So I know we are moving in a healing direction, that things are changing, and I'm positive, you know?
Yeah. I mean, do you think that those in what we call the afterlife realm can affect, you know, can do things like for the betterment of mankind? Absolutely. Or is it, I mean,
no, I think they're working with us. I think there are many who are working with us. I had an experience in which they called it something very simple, the Earth Project, which you think, well, that's not very creative, Earth Project. But I received a letter after a miracle came out from a woman who'd been head of the SWAT team. She was one of the first women in police work with. And she had all kinds of experiences. And she even, you know, remembered her birth. I mean, it was very interesting. But then she didn't know about the Earth Project, but she told me that when she was with spirit, that there was like a huge group of people, and they were all discussing, she said, what they called, and I thought it was quite a simple word, the Earth Quiet Project, or phrase. I said, they call it Earth Project? She said, yes. Oh, she said, on the other side, that people who've been scientists are passing information through. They're working in every way they can to help us get through this tremendous transition. And that was my experience, that they definitely are merchants of light. That's the name of my second book. That's exactly, they are an energy field, and we have called that energy field to us. That's the light that I was talking about. And beings with a higher frequency can now be born, and the spirit world can help us easier now with this higher frequency that we've drawn to us. The people who love, you know, people think, well, I've not done anything. Yes, you have. If you've loved, you are helping to root that light in the earth, you know, to anchor it. Mm. So when so many people who will never be known are helping the spirit world work with us to heal us. So I'm convinced of that. Yeah.
And then you sometimes you wonder if there are negative energies that are counteracting the light.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm sure that's true too. We see it on the earth, you know, that's certainly going on. And yes, I think there's always that that conflict. And that helps us to grow, however. If we had no conflict, you know, not be as creative.
Well, we should all be growing nicely because we certainly all have a lot of conflict in our lives.
Or do we ever? Well, I think it's quite a conflict. The energy fields are very powerful on both sides. But I think it's good for us to, we certainly see the darkness, but I think it's so important that we remember that the highest frequency in the universe is love. That is the greatest light. And it can do so much more than we sometimes think.
Well, I think that's a good place to end this on that note. It's been a lot of fun catching up with my California cousins.
Oh, yes, so indeed. Beautiful. I was just thinking, I love this, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
This is just Jen.
That's right. We can make it a foursome when Janet's back next time. One time when you're
feeling. We might have to do that. Well, you'll have to invite me back.
Oh, we will. We will.
Well, thank you all for joining us, listening tonight. And we'll see you next week. Everybody have a good weekend coming up, and be safe and be well. Good night.
Good night.